Chapter 26. Route in the East. Romania nevertheless had been a considerable morsel, 15 divisions, 560,000 men, five times the numbers of the British infantry on August 4, 1914. Geographically and strategically, her position was essential. Romania had been able to prevent the Russians, after August 1, 1914, from swarming into the Balkans. Had she been united with St. Petersburg from the onset of the war, she would have assured Russia's link-up with the Serbs and made it possible either to bring the Bulgarians over to the side of the Allies or to annihilate them, thus opening to Russia the road to Constantinople. That was why the Russians had done everything in their power to break up the defensive military pact which bound Bucharest to Vienna. Russian activities to corrupt the Romanians had been considerable. Deciphered communications revealed to me many times what was going on, Poincaré confessed. He had received M. Tăicănescu, the most notorious of the Romanians bought by the Tsar, in his private residence in the Rue du Commandant Marchand. The Romanian doorway to the Balkans was worth its weight in solid gold. The Russians had declared themselves ready to grant them everything, Transylvania, Banat, half of Bukovina. This generous promise of spoils seemed rather dubiously optimistic to Poincaré. He wrote, L'Invasion, page 33, these sales on credit of eastern populations and the pelts of live bears are a bit hazardous and childish. But the words are certainly apt, sale on credit of populations, populations were sold on credit to attract allies. M. Poincaré himself agreed to those sales unqualifiedly. They involved several million people, Transylvania alone had 3,700,000 inhabitants. Since the Romanians had dawdled so, the Germans, with their habitual sense of organization, had been able to prepare for the counter-thrust. They'd had the time to bring back some excellent divisions from the Russian front, which had been in a state of suspended animation for a month, and these, together with the Austro-Hungarian divisions, had been massed in Hungary in two great armies. The greedy Romanian politicians, thinking only of easy annexations, had stupidly massed almost all their troops at the same point, at the foot of the Carpathians in Transylvania. Even at 1-2, as was the usual situation throughout 1916, the disciplined, elite German soldiers always won. It would be the same in the Carpathians. In 18 days, from September 25 to October 13, 1916, 400,000 Romanians were swept aside, engulfed as if a tidal wave had overflowed them. The link-up of the German armies would be just a matter of tactics. On December 6, 1916, at Orsova on the Danube, they captured the last Romanian troops still offering resistance. The rest were no more than a horde fleeing towards the east. One more ally smashed to smithereens. The bad faith, the sale of peoples, the annexations, which were wrong by any standard, had only served to aggravate the western reverses of the Entente, now painfully parapet behind their hundreds of thousands of dead at Artois, Champagne, and Verdun. For the Russians, the Romanian debacle was going to be the straw that broke their back once and for all. The last hope of the Tsar had crumbled. The government, a delegate to the Russian Congress of the Union of Towns declared, has fallen into the hands of buffoons, sharpers, and traitors. In the Duma, on December 26, 1916, the socialists called openly for revolution. If you continue to fight this government by legal means, you are like Don Quixote, who tilted at windmills. That same evening, Rasputin, the great favorite of the Tsaritsa, the corrupt and omnipotent colossus, was poisoned, bludgeoned, machine-gunned, and thrown headfirst into the Neva through a hole chopped in the ice. The beaten troops were no longer willing to fight. The trains of pious priests had been derailed. The famished people readied their hammers and sickles. The last prime minister, Prince Galitzin, was an impotent old man. The minister of the interior, Protopopov, was a dotard who suffered from complete paralysis. At any moment the British ambassador wrote, Russia may burst into flames. Another 3 months and the Tsar would take the final plunge. The Tsarist regime had finally become aware that it was sinking in quicksand. Its head and arms were still afloat, but the sea of blood and mire would soon swallow them up. Germany, on learning of the coming collapse, had tried discreetly to offer the Tsar a helping hand. The Kaiser was his first cousin. Wilhelm II had never wished to make war against him. Besides, he more than ever needed all his forces on the Western Front in 1916. Negotiations got quietly underway. When the coded telegrams from the Romanian legation, which were deciphered in Paris, suggested the danger of a Russian withdrawal, the French and the British politicians were terrified. Clemenceau roared, "Then we are goners." It was imperative to quell immediately any possibility of a German offer and to offer more themselves, to promise so many benefits that the beneficiary, overwhelmed by the wealth of the gifts, could not refuse. The system had worked well with the Italians, the Romanians, and the Arabs. The draft of a Franco-Russian treaty was drawn up by the Secretary-General of French Foreign Affairs, Berthelot, the eminent Paris collaborator with the Balkan countries, who was said to have personally composed the text of the Serbian refusal of a joint committee to study the crime of Sarajevo. In 1916, in a new offer, Berthelot awarded the Russians the Austrian crown territory of Galicia, Hungarian Ruthenia, that part of Poland ruled by the Germans, and Constantinople and the Straits. Armenia as well, which had already been promised to the Armenians. Plus a large part of Asia Minor, including the Holy Land, which had been granted earlier to the Emir Hussein. With that document, the French government cancelled its promises of independence, previously given with great fanfare to the Czechs, the Ruthenians, and the Poles. As the Pan-Slavs had anticipated even before 1914, they would be reduced to the role of subjects in three Russian viceroyalties entrusted to three Grand Dukes. When Ambassador Paleolog received the text in St. Petersburg, with orders to transmit it immediately to the government of the Tsar, he exploded with indignation and sent Paris the following telegram, which is almost humorous in view of the fact that this French diplomat had unquestionably urged a war of conquest with Alsace-Lorraine as the prize. "Our country is not waging a war of conquest, but a war of liberation, a war of justice." And Paleolog added, "Our British and Italian allies will never go along with us, will never consent to such an increase in territory, an increase that will extend Russian power clear to the Mediterranean, clear to the Suez Canal." It was then necessary to send a French mission to Russia post-haste, so fearful was Paris that St. Petersburg would make peace with Germany behind its back. Like Paleolog, the French minister, Ribaud, refused to preside over the mission. Finally, the presidency of the mission was entrusted to the colonial minister, a pudgy little man from the south of France, not very polished, named Gaston Demergue. In return for the enormous territories the Panslavs were receiving, he was supposed to persuade the Tsar and Sazonov at St. Petersburg to sign the following text, containing the official commitments Russia was making to France. "Alsace-Lorraine will be returned to France unconditionally, not with the reduced boundaries set by the Treaty of Vienna, but with the boundaries it had prior to 1790. Its borders will extend as far as those of the ancient Duchy of Lorraine and will be drawn in accordance with the wishes of the French government in such a way as to reincorporate in French territory all the iron and steel works of the region as well as the coal fields of the Saar Valley. All other territory situated on the left bank of the Rhine and is now part of Germany will be completely detached from the latter country. Any such territory not incorporated into the territory of France will be formed into a neutral buffer state." Nicholas II warmly encouraged Demergue, "Take Mainz, take Koblenz, go as far as you like," Mark Ferro, La Grande Guerre, page 241. When the mission was over, little Gaston, grinning from ear to ear, triumphantly stated to the press, "Petit Parisien, Figaro, Le Temps, we have a closer and more cordial understanding than ever. Russian collaboration has not failed and will never fail." This on March 6, 1917. A week later to the day, on the stroke of midnight, the Tsarist regime would go up in smoke. Little Gaston had shown a shrewdness and farsightedness that was nothing short of stunning. Bryant, for all his astuteness, had been even less perspicacious than little Gaston. Historian Farrow writes, the Russians considered that the Straits comprised the compensation offered in return for Alsace-Lorraine. In return for the left bank of the Rhine, they wanted liberty of action on their western border, that is to say that France should abandon the cause of Polish independence. Bryant hesitated before acquiescing, but he resigned himself to it on March 10, 1917. La Grande Guerre, page 242. Thus Bryant, too, agreed to the treaty, but without England's having been informed. Once the French had crossed the Rubicon, the British would growl, but there was nothing they could do except acquiesce. The year 1916 had seen the battlefields of France strewn with the bodies of hundreds of thousands of British soldiers, and the waters of the Dardanelles dotted with the drowned sailors of their fleet. For Russia to abandon them would mean that the entire might of Turkey would be able to swing round on them on the Euphrates as well as in the Sinai. Like the others, the British rulers told themselves that promising wasn't the same as giving. All of them would be as slippery as eels, and they were called to account for their promises at Versailles in 1919. In March of 1917 the Russians and the French were equally blind. On March 8, 1917, in starving St. Petersburg, the mob broke into the butcher shops, grocery stores, and bakeries and cleaned them out. Protopopov, the Minister of the Interior, learned of the incidents without emotion, saying, "If there is going to be a revolution in Russia, it won't be for another 50 years." Reminiscent of the Tsar, who, 2 days before the war, had written in his personal notebook, "Today we played tennis. The weather was magnificent. And on the following day, I went for a walk by myself. It was very hot. Took a delicious bath. Happy the empty heads that don't even feel the hot breath of passing cannonballs." Minister Protopov's 50 years would last just 4 days. On March 12, 1917, the Russian government, abandoned by the troops, disappeared. The Duma and the St. Petersburg Soviet on March 14 set up a provisional government. Apparently, it was not yet more than halfway revolutionary. For its president and figurehead, it had Prince Lvov. Princes always abound in revolutions. Sometimes they are named Philippe Galate, are fanatics, vote for the decapitation of their relatives, and afterwards, as a well-deserved thank you for services rendered, are themselves made a head shorter. To counterbalance the princely crown of Lvov, a Jewish socialist was appointed to the impromptu government, Alexander Kerensky. On May 13, 1917, the Tsar's train was blocked by rioters. On the night of May 14, he abdicated, then went to bed. "I sleep long and moderately," he wrote calmly in his imperial notebook. For a moment he would still try to have his son accepted as regent of the empire. Then Grand Duke Michael. The latter would be Michael II for a few hours, then abdicate in turn. Then came the Republic. The Allies wanted to believe in that new Republic. "Perhaps it is the renewal of Russia," commented Bryant. London and Paris made haste to send eager delegations. Several cabinet ministers and some socialist deputies went running to the new Mecca, notably wealthy Marcel Cachin, the future leader of the French communists. They were overflowing with the eloquence and enthusiasm of fraternity. They even went so far as to approve imprudently the formula of the Soviets, peace without annexations or requisitions. The slogan didn't correspond to the agreement signed by the Tsar just before his overthrow, allotting hundreds of thousands of kilometers of territory. In that treaty, endorsed by both parties, the Tsar delivered almost the whole of Germany to French ambitions. On the other hand, the Cossacks were to be able to ride clear to Jerusalem. The new Russian Republicans would at most allow a referendum in Alsace-Lorraine, under the control of an international commission. Another affirmation which was very little in line with Allied policy: "The responsibility for the war lies with all of us. What then of the horrible Kaiser, solely responsible, and the gibbet already prepared for him?" The illusions were stubborn, and they became ever more dizzying. The Allied delegates rushed to embrace the leaders of the revolutionary government. They parted from their new brothers with tears in their eyes. They set out as shameless partisans, Pharaoh tells us, concerned about the interests of their governments, and they return from Russia singing the glories of the fatherland of the revolution. La Grande Guerre, page 332. With an eye to keeping up appearances, the Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs had made it a point to be soothing in his messages to the Allies. His foreign program, to combat the common enemy to the finish and without hesitation, and to respect the international obligations incurred by the fallen regime in a steadfast manner. Prince Lvov having been liquidated without delay, Kerensky became Minister of War. He left to harangue the troops at the front. The peasant soldiers thought only of deserting the army and getting back to their villages in time to obtain their share of the distribution of land, the only point in the revolutionary program that interested them. The military command fell apart, some generals were assassinated, others vanished. With a glorious lack of comprehension, Nivelle, the French commanding general, nonetheless demanded that the disintegrating Russian army go back on the offensive. In Paris, the future Marshal Petain, always calm and clear-headed, retorted with extreme skepticism, "The Russian army is nothing but a facade. We must be prepared for it to collapse as soon as it makes a move." Miraculously, it did move. The Russian offensive demanded by Nivelle got underway on July 1, 1917, on a 40-kilometer front, 23 divisions, commanded by Brusilov, the perennial prime mover. The first day yielded astonishing results. His troops defeated the first line of Austro-German forces. But there wasn't a second day. Brusilov had taken 10,000 prisoners, they would be the last. Old Petain was right. Some Russian divisions refused to attack. There was no way to compel the troops to fight, Brusilov acknowledged. The enemy counterattacked. This time it was the Germans, the soldiers par excellence, driving the Russians in a frantic flight through Galicia, which was completely lost in 10 days, with 160,000 killed, wounded, and taken prisoner. A month later, General von Huffier would have only to give the Duma a little shove to take possession of Riga. It was a rout. In France, too, it would soon be close to a rout.